and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is the last member of the Yang family.
Joel. Whoa! Don't spread that around. I don't want people. Oh my God! There's already people outside my house. They want my blood.
Yeah, I told them about you.
Oh, thanks a lot. Loyalty to the end.
Yeah, I'm the rogue general. I'm gonna start a revolution.
He really tried to.
Mm-hmm.
I actually didn't read about him, but that's also a real person.
Yeah, it definitely did feel like a historical.
In China?
Yeah.
Yep. In China.
Yeah, which is strange.
Kinda. Yeah.
Okay, so the movie is, this is the second half of our 1955 pairing with I Live in Fear. This is the Mizoguchi film, Princess Yang,
Quifei.
Because in the subtitles it was Guifei.
Right, that's technically her title.
The Japanese pronunciation, like Chinese spelling of it, but Quifei is like the Japanese way of spelling out?
Not from what I was reading, that is the way it was in China, but like, you know, my only reference is the Wikipedia article I was reading.
Okay.
So who knows how accurate that was, but it had basically the same information. Now, that other title you were talking about, according to this same article, was the topmost rank courtesan or whatever the word is for the top wife for the emperor at the time, and he actually invented that title for her.
Oh, okay.
Like I said, I'm getting this all from that Wikipedia article, so who knows?
I'm sure some of it is
accurate.
Yeah.
Yes, it has. You know, some of them do have the needed references, but
yeah.
A lot of it is just telling the story, basically.
Yeah. Okay. I just found another thing to bring up later. Anyway, we were on some riff when we started. That I was gonna say something about, but I forgot.
About the riff?
What was I gonna say?
You missed your moment. The riff's gone.
I know.
That's the way riffs work.
Yeah, so,
you'll never make it in this business.
Yeah, that's what I'll never be, my brain's, today's my 10-hour day.
So oh, man.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so 1955, this is a historical drama, I guess. Like, it's a costume drama, but not like the... Like the Edo period, like the Meiko Restoration, I think it was called. Not Meiko. I can't remember what it's called offhand. Like a lot of the costume dramas we covered are like from set in like the 1700s, 1800s Japan, and this is I think the earliest one we've covered, which is setting wise, which I think was like 8th century CE China.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a strange, subject, given that it's a specifically Chinese story about like Chinese history, but it's done by Kenji Mizoguchi.
Yeah. I mean, it's just apparently a popular enough story that he wanted to tell his version of it, I guess. I don't know how he got assigned his movies or what.
Yeah, this was towards the end. This was one of his last, I think, Street or Shame was his last movie. But
yep.
Yeah, I'm sure I've checked that at a time.
And this is supposed to be his first color movie?
Yes. It was his third to last film.
I see.
Okay, yeah. So one of the first things I noticed when I turned it on was, did you remember who any of the producers were?
The Shaw Brothers.
Yeah, Run Run Shaw of the Shaw Brothers was a producer on this, and my first thought was, I never thought we'd cover something with a Shaw Brother involved.
Yeah.
On here at any point.
Oh, that's Hong Kong, isn't it?
Shaw Brothers?
Yeah.
I don't know enough about. I like their movies for the most part.
I see.
They kind of like run together at a certain point once you've seen enough.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's what happens.
Yeah.
Let's see. Shaw Brothers Studios Hong Kong Limited. Yeah, they're definitely. So maybe that's part of the. Maybe it's a co-production between Japan and China.
Yeah,
Or at least Japan and Hong Kong.
it was a Dai film. Dai was kind of not lesser, but a less successful studio compared to like Shochiku, which Mizoguchi usually worked with, and so Shochiku was the Ozu's like mainstay for his whole career, and
Sure.
Kinoshita was there, and you have like Toho, and Dai is kind of like a step below, which was their main thing is the Gamera films, and that's kind of like their big staple for a long time.
Yep, those are important movies to Americans who had to live through the 80s and 90s and got those free channels on TV, and I assume Mystery Science Theater 3000, but I haven't actually seen basically any of that show.
It's not for me. Like, I'd rather watch the movies themselves than have commentary by puppets.
Well, get your own puppets. You can make your own show. Come on.
Yeah. Oh, and Princess Yang Kwefi, Kwefi,
Just use the Japanese title.
which is that for his title?
It is, or no, it's not the Japanese title. It's the her Chinese proper title, Yang Guifei.
Yang Guifei.
Yeah.
Yang Guifei, this was one of Fumio Hamasaka's last scores. He was the pretty much any like important Japanese film from like 45, 46 to 55 was scored by him. He did Rashomon and Seven Samurai and some, I think he did some Ozus and a whole bunch of stuff. And yeah, I don't know. Like, I think it's kind of clear. Like, I like this movie, but I don't have much to really say about it.
It's pretty straightforward. The only things that are interesting about it, I think, are the weird bookends.
Yeah.
Like for some reason, the way the movie starts out is we see an older man who is living somewhere where he's got an amazing view, so that's nice. But
Yeah.
he's surrounded by like treasures, like artwork and statues and stuff like that. And these two men come to see him and say, "Your son, the prince or the emperor, your son, the yeah, I think it is your son, the current emperor, has told us that you have to move rooms." And he's like, "How dare you speak to me that way? There's no way I'm going to do that." And these guys are like, "It's the emperor's orders. We have to move you." You know, he's like, "Get out of here before I lose my whatever." So he really doesn't want to leave the room.
Yeah.
And then the old man proceeds to go like, "Oh, this never would have happened if blah blah blah, and
And
you died."
there's some mention of he, I don't think they directly say it, but you basically get the sense of he's a prisoner within the palace.
Yeah.
And it's you get the feeling of like there's a takeover, which there was, but it's like it's good foreshadowing of like he's essentially kept alive for like appearances in the show that the new regime isn't barbaric.
Well, the weird thing about it is when like we I think that does that ha that happens before the titles? Yeah, am I correct?
Maybe.
I can't see. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe that's why it's even weirder, because all of a sudden it transitions to them, like the royal chamber for the emperor, and this guy's trying to get some young lady noticed, and everyone's talking about how the emperor's been so depressed since his wife died and stuff like that. And I was like, wait a minute, is this a flashback? I don't, you know, there wasn't any visual cues to indicate that we've
Yeah.
gone back in time. Eventually, you know, it became apparent that that's what he was talking about. But like at during that bookend part, he's talking about how his wife died. And we flash back, and it's the same character, but he's obviously a much younger man. And he's talking about, oh, his wife just died. I was like, wait, he's been mourning her for this long? Wow, that's a tragic story.
Yeah.
But it turns out he was mourning somebody else in the future, which is the story of how that happened, or the movie is.
Yeah.
So it just feels a little scattered. It feels disorganized.
Yeah, like, of the Mizoguchis I've seen, this is the one I like the least.
Yeah.
Which, it's still a good movie. It's still, like, it's still very well shot. It's still, I like the costumes. I like the, it has the Mizoguchi theme of, like, the tragic woman being used by men in power in society thing that he does all the time. And yeah, it's still Mizoguchi. It's just, it's not like the Ugetsu level or like Sancho de Bailiff level.
Right. It feels like the other movies of his that I've seen, which are, I've only seen Ugetsu, the 47 Ronin, and Utamaro and His Five Women, but they have very similar feelings, so it doesn't, it's not like he made a really weird movie. Like, I feel like Kurosawa had some movies where he just, like, kind of stepped out of what he was comfortable with. But, you know, not too often.
Yeah, not too often, but...
But every once in a while, it was just like, whoa, what was he thinking when he did that?
Yeah, like having Toshiro in old man makeup, where it's like, huh, that's a big choice to make.
This movie had a man in old man makeup, too, see?
Yeah, but it wasn't...
It's the same movie.
Yeah. And, you know, the equivalent of a nuclear war in 8th century China was a revolt from the head general.
Yeah, and the Americans taking over was like the Yang family taking over.
Something like that.
Yeah. It's all coming together. Yeah. No, okay.
The emperor and I think it might be the emperor in the flashbacks. And the princess were both in Rashomon. The princess was the wife in Rashomon, and the other guy in Rashomon was...
The emperor guy was... Wasn't he the woodsman?
I think. Yeah, I think...
I'm looking... what year was Rashomon?
50. The woodcutter was your father, and the priest was one of the droids.
Oh, yeah. Duh. I did. So, oh, he was the he was that guy's husband. I can tell by his face on if you look on Letterboxd, it's like the picture of him tied up and staring at her when she's like, "Stop judging me."
In Rashomon. Yeah. I remember it now. So
that's cool.
Huh. Yeah, 5 years later, together again.
And he was in Ugetsu also.
And I'd like to point out that the actress, Machiko Koyo?
Machiko Koyo.
She is still alive.
That's cool.
Yeah.
She's got an amazing photo on Letterboxd. Like, I don't know what it's from. She's, like, orange-colored, and she's holding a gun. Some sort of, you know, noir thing.
I'm not looking at it.
She was the lady in the face of another?
I guess?
Yes, it totally was. It was his wife.
Okay, yeah, she definitely did look familiar. I just wasn't sure where exactly. Okay.
And another movie I saw that I don't recall anything about called Odd Obsession.
Hmm.
Cool. Man, she must have been really young. Face of the Another was...
66.
So yeah, she was... 11 years later? Boy. And she looks...
The same,
yeah.
Yeah, she was 40 when she did Face of Another.
That's crazy.
Hmm. Those makeup artists.
Mm-hmm. No, I think she just had good genes or something.
Yeah, and still kicking.
Yeah. You okay?
Yeah, okay.
You got tackled?
Yes.
All right. So during the flashback, like I said, somebody's trying to set up a young lady with the Emperor. The Emperor's like, get this thing away from me. Like, he has no interest. And it turns out there is a member of his council that is trying desperately to get one of his relatives checked out by the emperor, and there's these three older, or these these three young women, and each one has been rejected basically on site by him because he's still mourning his widow.
Yeah, he's a widow.
He's a widower.
Widow. Yeah.
His dead wife.
Yeah.
Words.
I don't think it's ever revealed how she died. I guess it's like gives us a sudden thing that happened.
Yeah. Either way, he's not happy. He wants to, you know, the officials and the council keep coming, you know, like, you have to meet with this person, you have to come read these documents. And he just wants to spend his days in his plum tree garden or composing music. Like, he's a great composer of music.
I believe he's first seen playing music in the flashback.
And he plays freeform jazz, which is really weird. No, he doesn't.
Nah.
Yeah, he doesn't want anything to do with that. So we go back to the place where this the woman who failed this test lives, and it's a restaurant owned by this guy's name is something Yang. Kyu Chung. Anyways,
I didn't get a good idea of what their names were in this.
I want to say it's Kyo Chung Yang, and he's trying to make a deal with this general who's An Lushan. Yeah. Anyways, this general's like, none of your plans are working out. You know, someday I'm going to be in charge of all this stuff, and you're going to be stuck here at this restaurant. The guy's like, no, I'm going to figure something out. And the general observes this young lady who's washing dishes, taking her stuff back to the kitchen. He's like, what about this girl? It's all of a sudden it's like a Cinderella story.
Yeah. Wait, is she singing or that's someone else?
Yeah, she is singing, because that comes back later in the movie. She sees somebody else singing the same song. So he's like, no, she's, I'm gonna go over there and physically assault her until I can figure out if she's beautiful or not. So yeah, he like grabs her face, like, what's your name, like, blah blah blah, he's my cousin. Like, okay, well, now we're gonna dress you up, and then we have a what is that Sandra Bullock movie where she has to become a model?
Miss Congeniality.
Yeah, that's what happens. That's what happens in this movie, except we don't see it. Never mind. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, kind of, but she's kind of given no choice because her family's like, well, you're the only thing that can help us get money, so we're not poor.
Right, and she's like being their kind of like servant girl because her family has passed away. Now, according to the article on Wikipedia, this was definitely not the case. She came from a good house, and she was in fact married to the emperor's son before she married the emperor.
Hmm.
But in this movie, they just kind of insert her into the palace life. You know, at first she's not making a big deal. Like, occasionally she's the chancellor is trying to get her to get noticed by the emperor by bringing in a dish or something like that. And there is a moment where the emperor is out amongst the plum trees, and he decides, I need to compose a song about these, how beautiful these plum trees are right now. So he gets out his sitar, whatever it is.
I'd say a goto, but goto is a Japanese instrument, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, what. I have no idea. I'm bad at instruments.
Yeah, like
he gets out his piano.
Gets out his harpsichord.
His ukulele, and he composes a song out of thin air, all about the plum trees. And she happens to be in the garden and is listening to it. Later that evening, the emperor is getting ready to go to bed. And he's not feeling great. He's depressed, of course. He's been depressed this whole time. He's a real sad sack, this emperor. And she brings in some stuff. I don't know, like a tray with like tea or something like that. I can't remember. I saw this 10 days ago. I apologize, listeners. This is always the case. You should be used to it by now.
Yeah.
I put the blame squarely on you. No. And he finally takes a moment to look at her, and he says, well, I can see what they've been trying to do here. You look very much like my dead wife. But I can tell you now, there is no hope for you. I can't get over her, and I'm not going to be looking for anyone else. So he, like, excuses her from the room, and she apologizes. And she goes into the sitting room and sees his instrument just lying there. And she decides, I'm going to play the same song that I heard him playing in the garden. And she does. She does a perfect rendition of the song he had made up just that day.
Yeah, she can learn by sight.
Mm-hmm. And sound.
Yeah. You know that there are like, people who can just listen to a song once and instantly play it.
Yeah, Mozart.
No, like, it's a thing. Like, some people have the ability to just, like, hear any song and instantly play it on whatever instrument they can play.
And robots, too.
Yeah.
And so the Emperor comes in, and he's actually kind of pissed off at this. He's like, what is this? Is this some kind of conspiracy? Are you trying to win my favor by playing this song? Like, and how did you even learn it? And she's like, I heard you playing it, and I thought it would comfort you. Like, she sincerely wants to comfort the Emperor. And he realizes that once she says it to him. And they become fast friends. I don't think they become, like, attached romantically until later.
Yeah, like, initially he's like, well, let's just hang out and be friends, basically.
Yep. And, you know, he's in better spirits. Everybody's feeling good about that. One night, she says, he can hear, like, the people outside celebrating. Like, I don't know if it's the new year or whatever it is. But she's like, maybe we can sneak out of the castle and go hang out with the common folk. He's like, yeah. Oh, that sounds wonderful. You know, which is funny to me, like a royal person being like, oh, yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, much like the festival sequence in Hen Fortress.
Where that's exactly what I thought of.
You know, when a princess finally is allowed to be herself, and the emperor's like, oh, hey, this is pretty cool. I like the common people.
I like them now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she does. They sneak out. He's got a robe on, and at first he's wearing a hood. When he takes it off, nobody seems to notice that he's the emperor.
Yeah. Well, up until photographs and the imprint press was common, basically, like, common people won't know what their own ruler looked like.
Yeah, that's true, but I feel like in these movies, there are definitely a bunch of times where people are like, oh, based on this drawing, I know that's the criminal. I'm going to report him or whatever. So they had some good police sketchmen back then.
Yeah.
They probably did, yeah, whenever they painted him to make him look more godlike.
Yeah, and I believe they're wearing these, like, weird headscarf things. Right. It almost looks like a nun's habit. It's kind of awkward, and then almost immediately they just take off their nun habits and just put it on this random woman who loves it.
Oh, she's very happy. It's probably the finest thing she's ever had on her head. They metaphorically let their hair down, and then they literally let their hair down. See what I'm saying?
Oh, I get it.
And she, yeah, so they go, and he's having a great time, and she gets some sort of weird pot sticker thing, and he's like, this tastes weird. And then later he's like, I think I actually like it. He's acting very childlike, but it's a nice moment in a movie. And I do feel like it endeared me to the Emperor and her as a character.
Yeah, like she's with her people again, she can feel comfortable, and he's learning a thing or two about being a better person and like getting over himself.
Well, experiencing life, you know, seeing that there is joy in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I at this point, I feel like we flash forward. They're definitely married at this point. She's become the head consort.
Yeah, like it's done in the way of like where Ozu would never show like a wedding or a major event. You'd figure it out by paying attention.
Yeah,
this is one of those things where like Amizuguchi was just probably like people know what a wedding's like. I'm just not gonna even bother. It's not relevant.
Yep. And hold on a second. Also, a motorcycle is passing by. Go away, motorcycle. And her three older sisters have been brought into the palace, are now part of the royal family. Her cousin that owned the restaurant has become a trusted advisor for the emperor. And Lucian? Nothing's happened to him. Like, basically, he got left in the lurch.
Was he the governor?
I think he said that he wanted to be the governor. He was just a general at that point. Okay. And eventually he did become the governor of several districts or whatever you would call them after threatening the other Yang.
So basically,
gets his name changed, by the way, which is weird.
Yeah, so basically he's a police chief, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what his deal is, but he looks like he's highly decorated, whatever he's all about.
Yeah, I feel like it'd be equivalent of like a police chief.
Well, he rolls an army, so police chief army.
Yeah. Much like in the book. Oh, man, what's that Philip K. Dick book?
Much like in real life.
It's the one where the police chief is also the head general of California. And he has a kid with a sister, and that's like a subplot.
Philip K. Dick book? You're thinking of...
It deals with...
The Red Fern Grows.
That's going to bother me. You keep going.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It's one of my favorite Philip K. Dick books.
Well, we see a scene where one of the sisters is being paraded through town. She's got a whole entourage of like bodyguards and stuff like that, and she's... held aloft in one of those taxis, and these people are just like, get out of the way, princess blah 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 is coming through, and somebody doesn't move fast enough, so they start to beat the crap out of that person.
Yeah.
And somebody in the crowd is like, you can't do that, down with the Yangs, and he starts hacking people, and he actually hits this lady who's inside this taxi in the arm, and they rush her through to get to the palace. But it's like, holy crap, these people are serious.
Yeah,
and there's talk all over the town that the Yangs are a terrible influence on the emperor, and they're destroying the once happy land. So a lot of negativity going towards that place. And in the background of everything is An Lushan, who, like I said, feels like he's got the he didn't get anything out of this whole deal, and he was the one who first noticed Princess Yang, you know, and set up the whole thing. So he feels, in this movie at least, he feels like he deserves the credit for this.
Yeah. Okay, I found the book I was trying to figure out. It's Flow My Tears, A Policeman Said. It's 74. It's from 1974. It's the one where, basically, a David Letterman type wakes up in a new dimension and... nobody knows who he is.
So David Letterman comes into a new dimension.
Yeah, it's a talk show host type.
Oh.
Like, basically, it's based off of David Letterman, very clearly, if you read it. And he wakes up in a world where he basically never existed.
That's weird.
And the villain is the police chief general who has an incest baby with his sister.
Oh, if you're going to have an incest baby, it might... That's weird, man. That's weird.
It's really good. This was after he sobered up and quit doing pills.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay.
This is a movie podcast.
I know.
We only talk about movies ever.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I don't... things start to fall apart. An Lushan is making himself more of a nuisance to the emperor's house and to the Yangs in general. He even takes the princess aside at one point and is basically threatening her, like, I could make this all disappear. You know, I'm the one who did this, and you guys haven't given me my fair share of what you've been getting, and I really don't appreciate that. And so people start talking about that now, too. Like, oh, I saw Princess Yang and the general were together talking in private, you know. And yeah. Eventually, well, An Lushun takes the step to raise an army to rebel against the emperor and hopefully destroy the Yangs in the process. So it moves from the palace into a bunch of camps because it's no longer safe at the palace. The people don't want them there anyways.
Yeah.
And it becomes incredibly dark at this point because not only is An Lushun moving towards the palace and defeating all the emperor's armies, and the chief counselor Yang guy is like giving bad advice, so he's also getting people killed in this case. He gets murdered at some point, and I can't remember. Like, is it because the people are like asking for his blood? Right, that's after the other part.
Yeah, like that. The whole revolt part is kind of murky.
Right. People are starving. Like the soldiers are starving. They haven't been able to eat, and the emperor's in his able to eat with Princess Yang. He actually seems to be having a good time. He's like, this reminds me of the time we went out into the village. You know, we're acting like commoners. Yeah. Like, oh, that's so nice. Yeah, and then one of them runs in and says, we've killed the three other princesses. So Princess Yang's sisters, all three of them, have been killed by the emperor's army. These aren't even the people that were revolting. You know?
Yeah, well, they have to kill all the Yangs because this new royal family is bad.
Yeah.
They
think that's what all went downhill.
Yeah, it's all from a perspective of... the story's from a perspective of the princess and emperor, so it's very... So, like, it's kind of this sudden when this, like, the revolt happens.
Yeah. Yeah, so they come in and they say, we demand this Counselor Yang's head also. And Counselor Yang, being a coward, is trying to get the hell out of there when the emperor's guard, personal guard, kills him in front of the emperor. And he apologizes to the emperor, saying, like, I shouldn't have done that in front of you. I apologize, you know, if you feel that my life should be taken because of this, let it happen. And the emperor's like, no, I understand why you did it. You had to do it. And somebody else comes in and says they're now calling for Princess Yang's head. They say they will not be satisfied until she is dead because she is part of the family. And so the emperor takes it upon himself to go out to the crowd and try to appease them, try to beg for them not to do this. Were you going to say something?
Nope.
Liar. While he's out there, kowtowing, making speeches, stomping the yard, whatever he's doing, Princess Yang is like, this is all my fault. I love the emperor so much that I'm going to sacrifice my own life so that this war doesn't go on any further. And so she turns herself into the emperor's guards. And they lead her away and they hang her. You know, we don't actually see her getting hanged, but they, like, hang a rope over a tree.
Yeah, and it's a weird... not... Like, it's not the typical, like Slipknot that you would see. Like, I don't know. It looked strange. Like, I don't know.
I mean, they must have hung people, right? They hanged people back then. Yeah. It's just not something I associate with other countries.
Oh. Where do you think Americans got it from?
I don't know. We're terrible people. I figured we invented it.
No, it's an ancient tradition.
Or the Europeans.
Yeah.
They're terrible. Yeah, so... And she's definitely dead. We see them take out her body, and the emperor, you know, takes one last look at her. And I think that's basically the end of the story. We get the last part of the bookend where he's like at a statue of her, and it's like, oh, I've never been the same since you died. This sucks. And that's the end of the movie. Now, I'm not feeling very enthusiastic about the movie. I did enjoy watching it, but it didn't feel... I don't know. It felt like the story was kind of haphazardly happening.
It felt
as they were like rushing through the life and of this princess here.
Yeah, it felt like almost too casual with the pacing. Or just like there wasn't like much at it didn't feel like there was much at stake. Like the story kind of just became them hanging out, which was fine, but it's just kind of like, oh, there's not much else going on. And it had, like, the, as I mentioned earlier, like, the whole, like, a woman in a tragic situation forced upon her by society, but it didn't feel like it was very... That idea was explored all that much, because at first it's like she's forced into becoming a courtesan, and then she ends up marrying the emperor. It's like, oh, I guess it worked out for her, I guess.
So to speak, yeah. She doesn't seem that bothered by it after her first scene where she's declared an unusual beauty or whatever.
Yeah, and this so like, I don't know. It's just
so the actual person, according to the article, is considered she's known as one of the four beauties of ancient China. So this is a thing, apparently.
Interesting.
And she is, yeah. Like I said, she was married to the prince, to the emperor's son. And the emperor basically kind of fell in love with her. And so instead of just like taking, you know, shaming his son and taking her as his consort, he made her become a nun.
Hmm.
And then he got a new wife for his son. And then he had her leave the nunnery so that she could become his consort.
All right.
There is no mention of An Lushan until the rebellion happens. So it doesn't seem like they had any interactions.
Hmm.
So that's just an added story. Like, part of the problem with the movie version is they want to show Princess Yang as 100% innocent, you know, wonderful, like, fairy tale princess, basically. And I think it would have been more interesting as a historical version, but I'm not sure that's a story anybody wants to tell necessarily either.
Yeah, like, it's just, I don't know, like, the cast was, like the cast was a lot of, like, familiar faces, if you watch a lot of Japanese movies from this time.
Yep.
And, Haruko Sugimura, she was in a whole bunch of stuff from the 40s and 50s. Like, we've only seen her, we've only covered, I think, three movies with her. End of Summer, Good Morning, and No Regrets. And she was one of the other sisters.
Wait a minute, it says here we've seen Good Morning, Red Beard, Tokyo Twilight, No Regrets for Our Youth. Did we watch Early Spring or Early Summer for this, or was that just me?
That was just you.
Oh, what about The End of Summer?
We did that.
She was also in Army. We've seen a bunch of movies with her in it.
No.
I didn't recognize her, but
yeah,
it happened.
Yeah, so the Shaw Brothers, when they became known as the Shaw Brothers, according to Wikipedia, remade this movie as The Magnificent Concubine.
Sure. Shaw and Sons. Interesting.
Yes, so...
Yeah, I saw a couple of different versions of this story.
Hmm.
Listed as movies, that is.
Apparently, it was in the remake by the Shaw Brothers was the first Chinese language film to win the Grand Prix for best interior photography and color at Cannes in 62.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I didn't know they were very notable pre like Kung Fu era.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that they're like the Corman Group or the Crown International. It's like they did have some gems,
Yeah.
but they just like pumped out movie after movie after movie. Pascal?
So how is there much crossover with I Live in Fear?
Well, was that before the podcast we were talking about old man and young man, or young man and old man makeup?
Yeah.
That's about it.
And same composer, Fumio Hayasaka. This was the last year of his life, unfortunately.
I did like the music in this, although I can't remember a specific strain or moment, but I did notice it.
Yeah, I
And I like the movie in general. I don't. Even though we're being kind of down on it, it just feels kind of generic compared to the rest of the stuff we've watched.
Yeah, for like Mizoguchi, this feels weirdly hollow.
Yeah.
But it's pretty to look at. I like the color, like the color design felt. I'm not sure if it was the restraints of the time or if it was intentional, but the colors were both like vibrant and flat at the same time,
Yeah.
which I can't really say I've seen that before, but it was a really interesting mix of like two like I didn't think that was a something you could do with a color palette for like a film.
Dai-Lei Studios. Dai-Dai-Ei.
Daiei.
They did the Quiet Duel.
Oh yeah, I always forget that.
And they did Cheerleader Camp in 1988. Sancho the Bailiff. Anyway, yeah, I can't really think of too many comparisons. I didn't,
Well,
we've never said we're good at this.
no.
It's just something we're trying for. I don't think.
Yes, this. It's luck of the draw if it's not something I'm familiar with.
So you want to talk 1955 movies?
Yeah, I have a couple. I'll start with the less obvious one. It's a British movie that. Okay, at first I have to say I haven't seen it, but
You're always doing
I'm
this.
familiar with the property. It's
You're
based
always
off
like,
of.
this movie came out. Oh yeah, did you like it? Oh, I've never seen it.
And I like the writer who wrote the series, TV series and other TV series. It's the Quartermass Experiment, and that's a long running Quartermass is a long running franchise in England where it was I think it started out as a science fiction film and then it turned to like some like TV series, like short TV series, and then it'd be like a movie, then TV movie, and it'd be like every decade there'd be a Quartermass thing. And Nigel Neill was always writing it, and to some capacity because it was his baby, and he kind of did a whole Quartermass franchise for like 40 years or so. And
I can't hear you because you haven't seen this movie. I don't. I'm just kidding.
but it's Nigel Neill. I have to bring up anything Nigel Neill because he's a great writer.
Have you seen any of Nigel Neill's movies?
I've seen two of his TV series.
Movies!
He didn't write. Wait, yeah, I think he wrote Halloween 3, if I remember
Oh man, he
correctly.
wrote the good one. Nice.
Yeah, but maybe like the first draft or something, because other people kind of rewrote it after him.
Sure.
You go. I have to check if Nitrilil did write that or not.
Well, there's a couple of obvious things that came from this year, and basically anything that I've seen is mostly the obvious stuff. So, you're going to talk about the Night of the Hunter, I take
it? Yeah. Because it has Delaware's Robert. I forgot his name already.
Yeah. And Lady of the Tramp came out this year, and that's a Disney movie people have seen. I've seen it a bunch of times. We had a rotation of Disney movies we were watching at our house. And this one always kind of creeped me out. Because it's about a randy dog who just really wants to get it on with this lady dog who's from the good side of town. He's from the bad side of town. And, you know, she ends up at the pound at one point, and there's some other dog talking about how hot this one dog is, this tramp. He's a tramp. He's been doing things all over town, if you know what I mean. And later, the lady's family has a baby, and she's, like, jealous of the baby, and there's these two Siamese cats, you know, with that famous racist song.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And, like, are these cats going to kill that baby? These are things I thought of when I was a young man. I haven't seen this movie in, like, a decade, or maybe longer.
Okay, so. I can confirm Nigel Neal and John Carpenter are uncredited with writing Halloween 3 Season of the Witch.
Well, that's good.
Tommy Lee Wallace has a screencraft, but Nigel Neal did work on that film to an extent.
That's why it's got that Irish part in it.
Maybe. It's plausible. He liked British stuff.
We had to throw him out. He kept saying the Irish were evil.
Maybe they killed him. He's been dead for over a decade.
There you go. Those robots finally caught up with him. But I do think Lady the Tramp has beautiful animation. I think, you know, it's a classic Disney film for a reason. It's very lovely to look at. And it's about dogs. Dogs are cute.
Yeah.
So that's what I have to say about that. Do you want to talk about a different movie?
Yeah, Night of the Hunter, I consider it a horror movie. I don't know about you, but
Yeah.
You do?
Okay. It's scary enough.
Yeah, like initially it doesn't feel like a horror movie, but then as it goes on, you're like, oh, this is kind of have its time, and certainly. And it's basically the story of, if you haven't seen it, it's Robert Mitchum plays this con man preacher who has tattooed on one hand hate, on the other hand love on his fist. And he does this whole, like, I'll say homily, but that's a Catholic thing. What's the Protestant version? Sermon. There we go. And there's, like, a sermon thing with, like, love conquering hate. And I believe hate is on the left and love is on the right.
He's got basically a parable about it that he says. Yeah, a story. And
referenced in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, where Ray Rahim has what do you call it? Like, the things that you wear, like a ring.
I don't know what those things are called. Those gigantic things.
Yes, where he's like wearing on his hand in gold, love and hate. And
R.I.P.
Yes, R.I.P. Ray Rahim. But Robert Mitchum's character, he's this preacher who preys on single moms who are widowed, and he picks these. Oh, I forgot to mention. So he was in prison with this guy who said he stashed a bunch of money in his house, and so the dad gets killed, and Robert Mitchum's like, I'm gonna track down that widow and seduce her so I can get all that money. But the kids of the widow are a little too smart.
Yeah, he would have got away with it too if it wasn't for those damn kids.
And there's this
and their old lady who in the beginning of the movie's head is floating.
Yeah, it's this very beautiful, creepy, you know, like Hollywood horror movie. But like,
yeah, there's some nightmare imagery. Like, I feel like this is comparable to like Psycho, although Psycho goes maybe just a little bit farther, but it's up there.
Yeah, I like it more in Psycho because the end of Psycho ruins a lot of movie, I think.
Impossible.
But, yeah, Night Hunter hurts on Criterion for a reason. I highly recommend it. It's just totally worth seeking out if you have not seen it.
Sure.
And has Delaware's Robert Mitchum.
Delaware?
He spent some of his childhood in Delaware.
Uh-huh. So, I'm not gonna pretend like I know anything about film. I'm just gonna say Night and Fog, which is a 32-minute documentary by Alain Resnais. I don't know how to say French. Night and Fog, 1955. It's 30 minutes all about the concentration camps, I believe in Poland, showing you what they look like then, just 10 years later. And it's mixed in with shots of some of the most disturbing, disgusting, scary things of things that actually happened, like history, like actual history. The film that the Nazis had taken of things that they were doing, and it's just, it's so effective that I feel like it has to be seen by everyone. If you haven't seen Night and Fog, it's incredibly powerful, and it is very, very upsetting, but I think that you have to see it. You have to remember how terrible the Holocaust was, and I know some people are just like, no, I don't need to be reminded of that, but it's important. And this 30-minute documentary does an amazing job of just putting you there. Anyways, yeah, so that's from 1955.
I have not seen it for that reason.
You should just watch it.
But once I heard someone, but I didn't know it was just 30 minutes, so.
Yeah, it's short, but man, I can't get the imagery out of my head.
Yeah, I thought it was like a 2-hour, like, thing.
There is a different documentary that he did that is 2 hours long.
Oh.
I thought the same thing, and then I do like a Criterion alphabet thing where I just go alphabetically, you know, A, B, C, whatever, and that came up under N, so I just watched it.
Mm.
Or maybe it's a different movie called Night and Fog. I can't remember. But, yeah, this particular version is only 30 minutes long.
Huh. You got
another one? You want to talk about the 7-year itch?
Nope. It's terrible. I
like it. No. I like it a lot.
I think you like it, too.
I mean, what's wrong with it?
It's barely a movie.
That's not true. It's a story about a guy.
Yep, who...
A guy who decides to cheat on his wife.
and he thinks his upstairs neighbor is attractive and looks like Marilyn Monroe, as he says at the end of the movie.
Well, I don't think she's I don't think she's his neighbor at the... Like, I think that's a room that she's happens to be renting just for the summer or whatever, right?
Whatever.
And it should be called. I mean, this guy's a total dork.
Yeah, it's just his fantasies of what if I did cheat on my wife and the whole of. Yeah, I get the metaphor. I get the metaphors for sex that you're doing.
What metaphors? He was practically on top of her.
There's one where he's playing piano and she's like almost moaning, and it's like, yep. Message received. It's just not interesting or clever.
Yeah, he has a bunch of dream sequences where he's super suave, and then of course he's not really suave, he's a dork. Yeah. This is the movie with the famous air vent blowing up.
Yeah.
Marilyn Monroe's skirt thing.
Which is a dream sequence.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, it's not good.
No.
I can't recommend it.
It should be called Richard Sherman Should Just Jerk Off.
It's a piece of history. That's because it's like, I don't know. No, like, I don't know what to say.
If you're going to watch a Marilyn Monroe movie, just watch How to Marry a Millionaire. It's much better.
No, you should watch The Misfits because it's weird.
How to Marry a Millionaire has, she like, it's a rom-com, and Marilyn Monroe is genuinely very, very funny in it.
Is she playing a dummy in that one?
Of course she is. That's all only part she could get, really.
She doesn't play a dummy in The Misfits. She's not like super smart or anything like that, but she's not doing the whole ingenue thing or whatever it is.
Yeah. Like all I knew about Monroe before I saw How to Marry a Millionaire was just she was like a sex symbol, and then watching, I was like, oh, she actually can act. And then I saw 7 years later, she's like, oh, what a waste.
That's what they hired her for.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Billy Wilder.
Yep. But that wasn't Billy Wilder. He did movies.
Yeah.
So, the only other one I want to mention is this movie called Three Cases of Murder, which has three different directors, three different stories. And, this is the problem. I can't really remember most of the movie, but there was this amazing story in it where a man who works in a museum has like been looking at a painting, you know, every time he goes to work, he's kind of fascinated with it. And then one day he notices that it's very Twilight Zone. He notices that there appears to be a light in the window of the painting. And so he gets closer to this thing, and eventually he just walks into it. And the man in the painting is like, oh, hey, you noticed, blah, blah, blah. And it just, like, unfolds in this really interesting way. And they're all three of the stories have their own interesting parts of that. But that one kind of blew me away because it was visually just like, I was... My mind was blown. I did not have very high expectations for it. Maybe I shouldn't be singing the praises. But yeah, Three Cases of Murder.
Okay. All right, so quickly, there are a couple other Noah movies that came out this year that I have not seen, but
no.
I need to spring up like that. I know that they exist. To Catch a Thief, the Hitchcock movie with Cary Grant, probably playing Cary Grant in that, but I'm sure it's good. I don't know much about that. And Hitchcock's A Trouble with Harry came out that year too. That's one I never hear anyone talk about. And Diabolique, which I never heard of until the last picture show did an episode on.
Oh man!
So the whole like crazy twist they talked about was like, I never heard of that twist ever.
The next picture show?
The last picture show.
Whatever it's called. There's a podcast called The Last Picture Show?
What? You know what I'm talking about.
You're talking about the one they used to buy the people who did the Dissolve, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's The Next Picture next. Show.
Whatever.
Picture Show is a movie.
I know that. I don't know. Whatever.
I just want, if people want to check it out.
Yes. But I want to point out, I never heard of Diabolique or the big twist that they talked about that was apparently super famous, but I just never encountered it. Yeah.
So there's no reason for you to watch the movie because you already know the twist now?
Apparently it's good enough that you don't have to. Like, it won't ruin it.
No, I understand. It is supposed to be really good. There also was two James Dean movies that came out that year.
Oh, yeah.
Rebel Without a Cause and East of Eden.
I thought... Wait. I thought Issa Eden was that weird sex comedy from the 90s with Rosie O'Donnell.
No, that's something else.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do know what you're talking about.
And on Comedy
With Dan
Central a lot.
Aykroyd.
Yes. Comedy Central would play it a lot, like when I was in middle school, and I'd always change the channel if it was on, because it's terrible.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that one's called. Maybe it is called East of Eden, but East of Eden is also a James Dean movie.
Okay. Not the porn star, the actor who died in a car crash.
Yes, he did. He died as he lived in a car crash.
Yeah.
And Lola Montez, I haven't seen that one, but that's a Max Ophüls movie, so it's probably really good.
Yeah.
Rafifi.
That's been on my Rafiki's been on my Netflix DVD list for like 3 years. I
Yeah.
keep pushing it back.
I have a copy, I just haven't watched it. Pather Panchali. I don't remember how to say this guy's name. Satyajit Ray. Yeah, he's supposed to be an amazing Indian filmmaker. I haven't watched any of his stuff yet. Yeah. So 55 is a good year, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm not very well versed. Yeah, so you got stuff to plug.
No, not really. I mean, why would you want to listen to me after this episode?
Yeah, if you made it this far, I'm sorry.
Hey, there's an Arus movie, Floating Clouds.
Yeah, I thought it was Flowing Weeds. I'm like, I've seen that, but Flowing Weeds was a couple years after this.
I see. Yeah, if you want to hear me actually make coherent sentences and not try to sound like a smart person, you can listen to me on Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space, which is a weekly science fiction and fantasy movie podcast that I do with my co-hosts Sarah and Aaron. Recently, we talked about Earth Girls Are Easy and A Life Less Ordinary, and we just released a special episode with Spencer on the movie Ready Player One, where Spencer and I tear into it, and poor Sarah, who liked the movie a lot, just has to listen to us be jerks.
Yeah, but I should say, I would recommend Ready Player One,
Me
even
too.
though it's very flawed, but still a watchable movie. Still,
Yeah, I'd say it's a theater movie. Go see it in the theater.
yeah. Or like when it's that later, being it'll just be forgotten because like it's just better on the big screen.
Now go to the theme park.
Yeah, with the hey, don't spoil
What?
that one part.
The special? Yeah, I wasn't talking about that.
Okay.
Anyways, that's available at the usual places: iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast Alley. That's a
Yeah.
thing, right? Please don't send me into outer space.
Yeah, Satan's Alley from Staying Alive. Never mind. You know, the sequel to Saturday Night Fever by Stallone.
Yeah, I know what Staying Alive is, but he has another movie that's called Something Alley.
No, but like the play in the movie is called Satan's Alley or something. It doesn't matter. That's a fascinating movie, but
They've already turned off the podcast by this point, okay?
yeah,
So.
probably. I was recently on the podcast FlixWise Canada, and I talked about this great African film called Darat, which means dry season in Arabic, and that will come out in about a month or so because Martin should be on our episode on Dodescaden, so where he's gonna try to like co-release his thing at the same time we release our episode. And what else? Jailhouse 701. I am finally done Battles with the Honor and Humanity series. It took way too long, and the journey's over. I'm a changed man. It's a wonderful bleak series if you can handle like really violent, bleak Yakuza stuff with like a dark sense of humor. It's for you. And if not, still check it out. It definitely is worth watching. And, yeah, that's it.
Sounds good. What are we watching next time?
Next time. Okay, my date's mixed up. Next time will be Dodeskoden.
All right.
Yeah, which is almost 3 hours, so.
So I should start watching now.
If you made it this far, sorry. This was like the plants were aligned in the wrong way this episode. And yeah, so Thug Life, Nakadai Forever, Chipmunk Shakes Forever, you know.
It's not our fault if the movie's not that interesting, okay? We're just, we're two guys trying our best.
Okay, yeah, look, we're not Albert Kane here. We can't like just dig into it or
Albert Kane, write in today if you enjoy us.
yeah, if you know we exist, let us know that you know that we exist.
Listeners, write up, hit up Albert Kane on Twitter, ask him to be on our podcast.
Okay.
Basically, what I'm saying is, Spencer, ask him to be on our podcast now.
I have a connection to him,
Nice. See?
yeah,
I go meet him. A little close enough.
yeah, you can meet him. You live in LA,
Hey,
basically.
Elric.
Are you going to touch his face?
Hey, if I can, yeah. I'm flying to Texas just to touch his face.
Okay.
Yep. Bye, people.
Yeah.
Their show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. Their show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. Their show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podient. Thank you for listening.